Well, good morning, everyone. This morning, we are starting what we call the thankfulness experiment. During the month of November, we choose as a church to be more intentional about our practice of gratitude. As we work our way towards Thanksgiving, we decide, hey, for 4 weeks, we're going to be even more intentional about being thankful. And there's a number of things that we're going to do this month that are going to help us be more intentional. And the first thing that we're going to do is what we call our heart check. Our heart check. This is going to be the thing that kind of launches us into this idea of gratitude and thankfulness. Now, I have to let you know, there will be some moments this morning when you are going to be tremendously uncomfortable. There will be some moments this morning when you will kind of slip towards some defensiveness. Here's my encouragement to you, my challenge to you. When you feel yourself moving in that defensive or uncomfortable place, if you want to get angry with me, go for it. I don't know how helpful it's going to be. When you feel yourself getting defensive, when you feel yourself feeling uncomfortable this morning, I pray that you would have the courage to risk some self-examination and ask yourself a couple of hard questions. Why am I feeling this way? What does this tell me about the condition of my heart? Because again, this morning is our heart check. We're going to be checking the condition of our hearts individually and collectively. And when we speak of hearts, it's important to realize that the word we're using, that Jesus used in the Gospels, the Greek word is cardia. And when we speak of cardia, it's where we get the word cardiac arrest, cardiology. It's talking about the heart. Here's the thing. When Jesus used the word cardia, he was not referring to this muscle in your chest that pumps blood through your body. That's not what Jesus was talking about when he used the word cardia. Cardia in the first century referred to one's consciousness. To refer to the heart in the first century, the way Jesus would have used it in the Gospels, was referring to your rational, moral, emotional makeup. It was the intellect. It was the will. The best way to think about the cardia is it was the place where priorities were set and decisions were made. So when Jesus talks about the heart, when he talks about your cardia, he's talking about the health of your priority setting and your decision making. So this morning, as we do our heart check, that's what we're checking. What's the health of your priority setting and your decision making? Now, full disclosure, we're going to talk a bunch about money. We are. And if you're a visitor here this morning, you're probably thinking, I knew it. That's all they talk about at church. Actually, we don't talk about it much. And it's actually to our shame because as followers of Jesus, Jesus talked about money all the time. In fact, Jesus talked about money more than he talked about heaven or hell. He talked about money more than he talked about sexuality issues. He talked about money more than he talked about foul language. He talked about money more than he talked about addiction or whatever your particular sin that you like to elevate as being a big time deal. He talked more about money than all of those things. It's estimated that at least a third of the parables of Jesus dealt with the issue of money. Why? Because Jesus understood that the condition of our hearts, our cardia, was directly linked to our approach to things like money. And Jesus talked about it all the time. Are you starting to feel a little uncomfortable yet? Because we're just getting started. These are some of the things that Jesus said. It's funny. Okay, as we were going through the slides this morning, you know, we do our sound check. We go through the slides. I go, well, here's something Jesus said that we don't like to hear. Here's another thing Jesus said that we don't like to hear. Here's another. I'll show you what I mean. No one can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. And he said to them, take care and be on your guard against all covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth or rust destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Greek word there being cardia. Where your treasure is, there you will find how you are setting priorities and making decisions. Where your treasure is, there your cardia is as well. How you deal with your stuff directly impacts how you set your priorities of what is important to you. I've heard it said, don't tell me what is important to you. Show me how you use your money and your time, and I'll tell you what's important to you. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. The condition of our heart is directly linked to our approach to stuff. So let's say you go to your annual checkup with your doctor. You go every year to see with your doctor, and they run their battery of tests. And this particular time, they're checking the condition of your physical heart, that blood-pumping organ in the middle of your chest. And so they do all the different tests. They do EKG, they do MRIs, they take blood samples, the whole deal. You go a week later to hear the results of the tests. And you sit in your doctor's office, and the doctor has before him the results of all your tests. And if the doctor looks at the results of your tests and says, based upon what we have found from all of the tests, I am very concerned about the condition of your heart. So concerned that I am recommending that you change your diet, you begin exercising, and I am prescribing the following medicines for you. And if that doesn't help, the next step for us is going to be surgery. How foolish are we if we look across to the doctor and go, what do you know? It's not your heart. It's my heart. And I know my heart better than you know my heart. Your prescription and your description of what I should do is not what I'm going to do. I'm going to leave this place because I know my heart better than you know my heart. And I'm going to go have some deep fried Twinkies. We laugh at that individual. This is essentially what we do to God. God, who created you and knows you better than you know yourself, has prescribed a way for you to live in relationship to stuff. God has told you, this is how I want you to take care of your heart in regards to money. And our response to God is, what do you know? I'd like a second opinion. Your prescription for how I'm supposed to live in regards to money is unreasonable. I'm gonna do it my way instead. We look at that and go, wow, how arrogant is that? God, what do you know? I know better. So here's the question. So Dr. God does the tests on the condition of your cardia. Having looked at the condition of your cardia, says, this is my prescription on how to have a healthy cardia. This is how you can have a life where you are making wise decisions and setting quality priorities. Here's my prescription. If you're looking for the prescription that God has for the condition of your heart, it can be summed up in one word: tithing. And we don't like that word. We do not like the word tithing at all. Remember I told you, you're going to feel uncomfortable or defensive at least a handful of times this morning. And when you do, Ask yourself the question, why? Because this really is not about money at all. It's really about hearts. And Jesus understood so very clearly that how we do money impacts our cardia in a big, big way. His prescription for a healthy heart is tithing. Now, if you're not sure what tithing is, one of the best ways I can describe tithing is to just give you two words. And those two words are this: generosity and obedience. If you attack the idea of tithing just thinking generosity and obedience, you're going to capture the heart of what tithing is all about. For me, this has been really important. I did not grow up in a home where tithing was talked about. We're a church-going family, and I assume my parents tithed and continue to tithe. I have no idea because we never talked about it. And because we never talked about it, when my wife and I got married, this was something that we didn't just instinctively do. We've had to learn how to be tithers. It was new for us. And so when we started talking about the idea, okay, it's generosity and obedience, that was really helpful. It's to the point now when I hear the word tithing, I just put those two words in. I substitute those. I go, oh, those make sense to me. Here's the thing, and I mentioned this last week, and I'll say it again. I am not going to avoid difficult conversations, because if I avoid difficult conversations with you, in that moment, I am willingly hindering our discipleship, and I'm not willing to do that. And so we're going to have hard conversations, and this is one of them. When it comes to tithing, when it comes to being a church that is generous and obedient, this is a generous church. This church does generosity so well. When there is a need that comes to the forefront, you respond. We respond. We do generosity so well. It's one of the things I absolutely love about this church. We do generosity. Obedience, let's just say it's a growing edge. This became awkwardly apparent to me in September and October, back in May. And if you're a visitor, we're just doing a little bit of, you know, family work here. Back in May, we set our new budget. And the budget that we set in May was an increase over the previous year. It was not a budget based upon the assumption that our congregation would tithe. Quite a statement, but it was a budget that was set not with the expectation that we would tithe as a congregation, but it was a budget set to help us step in that direction. It was not an unreasonable budget, but it was an increase. And June, July, August, we're doing really, really well. And then September came and our giving went. And every week our giving was about $2,000 short. I kind of look at it every, you know, I get the reports every week and I go, $2,000, almost to the dollar, you know, for the month. It's like, that's odd. And then in October, we heard of the fires in Santa Rosa and the fact that our sister churches in the Santa Rosa area were right in the middle of the relief effort. And there was a call that went out to our church, go, hey, we can't help with the relief effort. And boy, did you guys respond, just like I knew you would. And we instantly raised $2,000. Look at that. Anyway, it was the number that caught my attention. I was like, you know, for a month, every week, we were short $2,000, and when there was a need made, available to us, we responded with, we do generosity so well. We like that. Obedience? Not so well. And that's what tithing is. Tithing is generosity and obedience. It's not generosity or obedience. When I think of obedience, one of the people that always comes to my mind is Abraham. And when you think of Abraham, you go, oh, yeah, that was one obedient dude. I mean, just think, you know, God told him to kill his son and he was going to do it. But here's the thing. When I think of Abraham and his example of obedience, I don't initially think of the Abraham and Isaac story. I think of chapter 12 where God says to Abraham, go. Leave your family, leave all that you know, and go to the land that I will show you. And he did it. God didn't say, hey, leave your stuff. You're going to go here. Here's the address. Here's the direction. Here's Siri. He didn't do any of that. He goes, I want you to leave all that you know and simply go. And he did. Oh, that's some serious, courageous obedience. And we go, oh, you know, but he, Mike, he heard God's audible voice. I mean, if I heard God's audible voice, if I had a burning bush like Moses, then, you know, obviously I would respond with courageous obedience as well. Really? You've got a Bible. Moses and Abraham didn't have a Bible. You've got a Bible. Apparently this isn't clear. We say we worship a triune God, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, and the Holy Spirit dwells within us, but apparently the work of the Spirit isn't enough. But if I had an audible voice, you've got the Spirit of the living God and the Word of God, which is living. Let's compare two individuals in the Bible. You've got the rich young ruler versus Abraham. Both individuals heard directly from God. Rich young ruler. He goes up to Jesus, says, what must I do to have eternal life? Jesus says, sell all your stuff, give it to the poor, come follow me. Rich young ruler says, that's completely unrealistic. Nope. Walks away. Then you got Abraham. Abraham, essentially the same deal. What must I do? God goes, I want you to leave all your stuff, your family, your comforts behind, and go to the place that I will show you. And he did. Both said, what must I do? Both were told, leave stuff, come follow. One did, one didn't. Both had an audible word from God, but they responded radically differently. The issue is not the vehicle by which one receives the message. The issue is the faith, courage, and humility of the recipient of the message. I'll repeat that. The issue is not the vehicle by which one receives the message. Burning bush, audible voice, movement of the Spirit, Bible. The issue is not the vehicle by which one receives the message. The issue is the courage, humility, and faith of the recipient of the message. The next 3 weeks, we're going to be doing a sermon series that we're simply calling Profiles of Courageous Obedience. Each week, we're going to be looking through the scriptures at people who heard the call of God and responded with courage and obedience. Which takes us back. So what is God calling us, telling us, prescribing for us so that we could have a healthy heart? Which takes us right back to the whole idea of tithing. John Ortberg, one of my favorite authors, said this, the word tithe means a tenth part. Tithing means 10%. For Israel, however, tithing was really only a start. If you read through your Old Testament, you discover there are three different tithes that the people of Israel participated in. So if you're just doing the math game, they were giving 23%. I love that Ortberg said, tithing is a great floor, it's a lousy ceiling. In other words, the tithe is the starting place. This is where we begin. And I go, made my 10, I can do whatever. No, that's where we start. And then you go, okay, God, what else? How else do you want me to be using this? Dave Ramsey, out of curiosity, how many of you have ever heard of Dave Ramsey? Financial Peace University. There are going to be some opportunities coming up if you want to participate in some of the Dave Ramsey stuff, and we'll get information out to you. But Ramsey says this, So why does he, God, ask us to give 10% to him? Let's be honest, fair question. God doesn't need your money. He's got everything. He doesn't need it. His bank account is fine. Why? Tithing was created for our benefit. It is to teach us how to keep God first in our lives and how to be unselfish people. God goes, no, I'm going to give you a prescription so that your heart will be healthy. And the prescription is tithing. I don't need your money, but you need to deal with your money radically differently because it will help you. In fact, it'll help you to be an unselfish person. And by the way, unselfish people make better husbands, make better wives, make better parents, make better kids, make better employees, make better employers. The world is a much better place when we are unselfish. So God goes, hey, I'm gonna tell you to tithe because it's gonna make things better. It will be better for your heart. I shared this a couple of weeks ago. My late mentor, Ernie Hansen, I miss that man. But I remember the day he said, when you don't live as God calls you to live, you're not just a sinner, you're an idiot. It's just a great line, especially coming from Ernie. You know, I just never expected to hear that language out of Ernie. But it's true. When we don't live as God calls us to live, when God says tithe, and we say, no, I'm going to do a different version of it, something that's more comfortable for me, something that works better for me in my opinion, because after all, it's my heart. When we choose to live differently than God's called us to live, that in its, at that very moment, is an act of disobedience. That's what sin is. And yet, nobody likes to be called a sinner. We don't like that. If we don't tithe at that moment, we're sinning. But I love what Ernie said. He says, when you don't live as God calls you to live, you're not just a sinner, you're an idiot. I've given you a better way. This will help you. And we go, give me more Twinkies. I don't need this advice, God. My heart and I like Twinkies. In Richard Foster's book, The Freedom of Simplicity, a great title in and of itself, but he wrote, no doubt you noted that Jesus did not condemn the tithe as such. He said, these you ought to have done without neglecting the others. This is Jesus's way of saying, duh. When talking about tithing, you know, in that context, he's looking at this group of people and he goes, well, tithing, duh. You know, do we have a problem with this? He goes, the tithe is not necessarily evil. It simply cannot provide sufficient base for Jesus' call to carefree unconcern over provision. It fails to dethrone the rival god of materialism. So when Jesus, we go, why didn't Jesus talk about the tithe more? If it's really important, why doesn't Jesus talk about it more? Well, here's the reason. He goes, well, you ought to have done that. I mean, we all okay there to his audience. He goes, tithing, well, duh. But like Ortberg said, it's a lousy ceiling. It's just, it's the starting place. In fact, Foster goes on to say, the tithe simply is not a sufficiently radical concept to embody the carefree unconcern for possessions that marks life in the kingdom of God. Jesus Christ is the Lord of all our goods, not just 10%. So why does Jesus not make a big deal about the tithe? Because he was all about the whole word, all. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind, all your strength, and you should love all your neighbors. All was a much more important word for Jesus than tithe. Tithe for him was like, well, duh. That's obvious. It's the good floor, but let's start growing. Like I said, you might get uncomfortable as we go along here. And again, every time you feel yourself getting defensive or uncomfortable this morning, you can get mad at me, but it's probably not going to do you a lot of good. Ask yourself the question, why am I feeling this way? Why am I uncomfortable? What does this say about the condition of my heart? Last year, I shared with you a study done by Relevant Magazine where they just looked at how much money Christians give. And what their research discovered is that Christians don't do it that well. I know, big shocker, but you know, some of the things they discovered was that tithers make up only 10 to 25% of a normal congregation. This is a normal congregation. That being said, I have no idea how much any of you give. I have no idea. I don't see those records. I know how much my wife and I give, and that's it. But I can look at the numbers of how much we give collectively, and okay, we're probably pretty normal. 10 to 25% of the people in this church are tithers. Only 5% of the U.S. tithes, with 80% of Americans only giving 2% of their income. Christians are only given at a 2.5% per capita, while during the Great Depression, they gave it at a 3.3% rate. Ow. Now, we can take these statistics in a couple of different directions. We can take them as just a sledgehammer, you know, and just pounding away at us. Or, and I tend to be an off-the-chart optimist. I'm not a glass half empty. I'm not a glass half full. I'm a glass overflowing with opportunity. I see these kind of numbers and I go, oh, look what could happen. And Relevant Magazine, as they were doing this study, discovered that if all of the self-professed Christians in the United States tithed, there would be an additional $165 billion, that's with a B. If all of the self-professed Christians in the United States tithe, there would be an additional $165 billion made available to and through the church annually. What could you do with $165 billion? And hopefully the church's response would be, well, we're going to take even more care of ourselves. No, we have an opportunity then to take care of the people around us. Like with Abraham, I'm going to bless you so that you can be a blessing to everyone. This is what could happen with $165 billion. $25 billion could relieve global hunger, starvation, and deaths from preventable diseases in 5 years. $12 billion could eliminate illiteracy in 5 years. $15 billion could solve the world's water and sanitation issues, specifically at places in the world where 1 billion people live on less than a dollar a day. $1 billion could fully fund all overseas mission work. And there'd still be over $100 billion left over. Hurricane Irma came through, destroyed Puerto Rico. Estimation of the cost to rebuild Puerto Rico is somewhere between $45 and $95 billion. Wouldn't it be amazing if that number comes up and the church in the United States goes, we got this one. Hey, everybody else, keep doing what you're doing. You got lots of stuff on your plate. The Church of Jesus Christ is going to rebuild Puerto Rico. If the Church of Jesus Christ tithed, we collectively, we're a really big body, could do that. What kind of witness would that be in our world that has a fairly jaded opinion of the church? Jaded for good reason, quite frankly. The younger generation, the generation that everybody is writing about just fleeing from the church. There was a book written a handful of years ago called Unchristian, and it was a study of 18 to 29-year-olds and their perception of the church. And when asked about what Christians are, this is what 18 to 29-year-olds said. And this was both Christian and non-Christian kids. Overwhelming. The top three answers to the question, or filling in the blank, Christians are, top three answers. Hypocritical, judgmental, more concerned about their politics than their Jesus. That was the opinion of 18 to 29-year-olds, and quite frankly, we have earned that perception. This is also the same generation, by the way, that tends to be ridiculously generous. This is the Kickstarter generation. They want to help. They are willing to help. And if the Church of Jesus Christ was actually a generous and obedient church, and we suddenly go, we'll take care of Puerto Rico, that generation would notice. They might not understand or agree with all of our theology, but they would see what was being done through the church and go, I want to be part of that. We talk about how we're going to reach the younger generation. If we're a church that is both generous and obedient, I guarantee the example that is set speaks volumes to that generation. Or we could just keep eating Twinkies. God's given a prescription. We go, oh, but I know my heart better than you do. You just made me. What we give reveals something about our hearts. But how we give also reveals something about our hearts. And again, if you haven't felt uncomfortable yet, buckle up. What we give says something about the condition of our heart. How we give does too. I have a love-hate relationship with designated giving. And Hal's sitting right over here. Hal and I have a bunch, he's kind of smiling at me right now because we've had lots of conversations about this. I have a love-hate relationship with designated giving. If you're not sure what designated giving is, let me explain. In most churches, you have the general fund, and people give to the general fund, and that is the monies that are used to do all the stuff that a church does, inside and outside. And then churches will often have some other designated projects that people then give specifically to those. We have at least 30 designated accounts in this church. Like I said, I have a love-hate relationship with designated giving. On the love side, it is physical evidence of the generosity of this church. No doubt about it. I can look at how we respond to specific needs and go, wow, our church gets it. On the flip side, if we were obedient, there would be absolutely no need to have designated accounts because we would have more money available to us to be able to give away to all of those different projects. We would have no need for a designated account for missions because we would have all that we needed to care for all of the mission projects that we currently are part of. We would have no need for an agape fund. And the agape fund is money that we take in and then we give it all away. It's awesome. I love the agape fund. But if we were actually practicing the obedient part of tithing, we would have more available for the agape fund than we currently do. There are two groups of people in this church. And again, I have no idea how any of you give. Group number one is the group that tithes and gives to designated accounts. To which I say to you, well done, you're giving in a biblical manner. Keep it up. You tithe, it's the floor, and then... Second group, you don't tithe, but you give to designated accounts. To that group, I ask the question, why? Why do you do it that way? Again, what does it say about your heart? I want you to do something for me. I want you to take one hand and go like this. Just go like this for me. All right, everybody doing this? You guys doing well, all right. Next hand, go like this, all right? Of your two hands, which one can hold more? Which one has the most amount of control? We like control. I'm going to control how I give. Here's the thing. Which hand holds more? This one. When we choose control over obedience, we almost always give less. You just can't give as much as when you go, I'm giving up control. I'm going to choose obedience. How we give says something about the condition of our heart. Yes, but I want to make sure my money's going where I want it to. How we give says something about the condition of our heart. So I give at the end of the month after I've paid all my other bills. I give when I've got some extra. Again, what does it say about the heart? I give at the end of the year for tax purposes. One of my other mentors, pastor of a large church, multi-million dollar budget, And I remember one day he told me, he goes, Mike, I wish there wasn't a tax break for giving to the church. I kind of looked at him and go, what? He goes, no, seriously, Mike, I wish there wasn't a tax break. Because it would eliminate all doubt as to the heart behind the gift. And again, it's about the heart. It's about the condition of the heart. Now, that being said, the current law means that there is a tax break. You should take advantage of it. That's good stewardship. But Kurt's observation rang true with me. It would eliminate all doubt as to the heart behind the gift. What we give says a lot about the condition of our heart. How we give says a lot about the condition of our heart as well. I had you do the fist thing a few moments ago. When I ran track, one of the things that they taught me early on is you cannot run with fists. Well, you can run, you just don't run well. Again, grab your hands, make two fists for me. Squeeze tight for a moment. You'll notice when you squeeze tight, the muscles in your arm tense up. You feel it, your tricep, your bicep, they tense up. The muscles in your forearm, they kind of tense up. When your muscles are tense, it decreases your ability to run well. You lose the flexibility. Have you ever watched the Olympics when they show the sprinters in slow motion and their faces are going, you know, and they're, it's like every muscle that doesn't need to be used for the race is suddenly loose and it just jiggles. Because they realize that if you tense up, you stop running as fast. Hey, when we go, this is how I'm going to give, with more control, because I want to take care in my way, we stop running free. Again, God goes, hey, I created you. I want what's best for you. Which is why in track, they taught me to run like this, just to loosen up. To force me not to do this. God goes, I'm going to force you. Let go. In Henry Nouwen's book, With Open Hands, it's a book on prayer that's brilliant. But this is one of the prayers in the book. He says, Dear God, I am so afraid to open my clenched fists. Who will I be when I have nothing left to hold on to? Who will I be when I stand before you with empty hands? Please help me to gradually open my hands and to discover that I am not what I own, but what you want to give me. And what you want to give me is love, unconditional, everlasting love. So how do we move to a place where we are more healthy, where our hearts are healthier? A prayer of confession like this, really good place to start. But I'm going to give you three steps to a healthier heart. We'll cruise through here. One, gratitude. Practice gratitude. First step. If you're practicing gratitude, you've made a huge step towards having a healthier heart. In Winnie the Pooh, it says, Piglet noticed that even though he had a very small heart, it could hold a rather large amount of gratitude. I love that. Never been a fan of Piglet until that moment. In Psalm 100, it's said to be a psalm for giving grateful praise. Shout for joy to the Lord, all the earth. Worship the Lord with gladness. Come before him with joyful songs. Know that the Lord is God. It is he who made us, and we are his. We are his people, the sheep of his pasture. Enter his gates with thanksgiving and his courts with praise. Give thanks to him and praise his name. For the Lord is good and his love endures forever. His faithfulness continues through all generations. Start with gratitude. We're going to be introducing a couple of practices this month that are just for the purpose of helping us with the discipline of gratitude. Behind me is a cross. Right now, it's rather stark. By the time we get to the end of the month, it won't be, because we're going to be filling it with our thanks. We'll tell you how in just a few moments. Second step to a healthier heart, prayer. Maya Angelou said, let gratitude be the pillow upon which you kneel to say your nightly prayer. I absolutely love the imagery there. I'm going to start with gratitude and let that be the place that spurs me into praying. First Chronicles says, look to the Lord and his face. Seek his face always. I love the word always. Praying is something that's an always reality. Gratitude, prayer, and finally faith. Martin Luther King said, take the first step in faith. You don't have to see the whole staircase. Just take the first step. Total Abraham thing. Go to the place that I will show you. But you're not going to see where you're supposed to go until you start taking those steps. Paul said this in Romans, may the God of hope fill you with all joy and peace as you trust him, so that you may overflow with hope by the power of the Holy Spirit. What it gets down to is this: do I choose to believe that the way God has called me to live is actually the best way for me to live my life? Do I believe that to be true? One of the books I'm reading right now describes this paradox as functional atheism. Functional atheism. We proclaim that we believe in God, and then we live our lives as if God didn't exist. Oh, yes, I believe in God, but not with how I use my resources. Either we obey or we don't. Gratitude, prayer, faith. So here's your next step. Here comes your homework. You ready? In the seat back in front of you is something like this. I need you to pick it up carefully because there's something inside of it. Prizes for everybody. All right, so go ahead and pull this out. Now, inside of it is a Ziploc with pieces of paper. Take the Ziploc out, hold on one hand, but I still want to focus on your heart check. On your heart check. Now, inside of the heart check, keep this with you for the entire month. There are things in here to help you be intentionally grateful, prayerful, and faith-filled. It's just a good homework for you for the entire month. Kind of work through the gratitude piece. Look at the prayer piece. On the back, reflection questions, those things that make you uncomfortable. This is to help you through the entire month. Now go to your baggie. Go to your baggie. Open up your baggie. Take out one piece of paper. Just one. Don't take out the one with the instructions. You'll need that for later. Take out one. Doesn't matter which color. Throughout the rest of the week, what you're going to be doing is every night you take out one piece of paper. You write down 10 things you are thankful for. You might want to do it around the dinner table. It's a great way to have a conversation at dinner. Write down 10 things. The next day, you take your baggie, you add another one. 10 things. Every night, 10 things. Next week when you come, we're going to take not one, we're going to take two offerings. One offering is just going to be a thanks offering. You're going to bring your baggie full of your 70, I did that math in my head, the 70 things you're thankful for. But we're going to start this morning, right here. I'm going to ask the worship team to come up, and you're going to start the process towards a healthier heart by writing down 10 things you're thankful for right here, right now. And in a little bit, the band's going to start playing. You can, whenever you're finished writing, just bring it up. Bring it up, put it on the communion table. If you have difficulty, you know, moving about, hand it to the end of the row, put it up in the air. Maybe one of the ushers can grab it for you. But while we sing, write, and after you've finished writing 10 things you're thankful for, we're intentionally grateful. Just bring it up, put it on the communion table, and that's going to be our first step to a healthier heart.